Good evening.
Good evening. Isaac, it's really great to welcome you here and have you in the white chair this evening. Welcome. Let's start where you began, and let's just find out what family life was like for you when you were little.
So I was born in South Korea back in 1975. We moved very early, actually, to Kuwait, where we lived for 3.5-4 years. My father sold and still sells car tires, life first took us to Kuwait, and then we went back to Korea. And by the age of six, I was in the UK. So I guess life in those early years was fairly hectic. Korea wasn't the most prominent country in terms of wealth. In fact, I remember it very clearly being just above Burkina Faso, in the amongst the world's kind of poorest nations. And I think my father, certainly both my parents, had to work quite hard to ensure both their work was being done to increase the prestige and wealth of the country, but also that they were also working hard to provide for a reasonable future for us. So I don't remember very much about those early years, if I'm honest with you, and certainly my first real and established memories are when we were back in Korea when I was about five, but we only lived there for 14 months or so before we came to the UK. Things were pretty busy, I think, but mainly for my parents.
So being great travellers around the world with your father's job, I mean, you say that your dad was a car tire man. I mean, we're not really kind of talking about the man with the iron bar.
No, I mean, he sells a lot of tires.
He sold lots of tires.
Yeah, so about, yeah. I think it's about 180 million a year now.
180 million a year. Okay.
So he runs a company called Hankook, or he used to run a company called Hankook Tires. He was their chief executive. And they're the sixth or seventh largest company in the world. But back then, actually, they were... back then they were small, and they were
Your humility on this is fantastic. I mean, we're just we've got a lovely photograph of your dad with one of his clients. There's I think that was two fronts and a rear. I think it was and a good job done there. I think they'll put it back on. I think it's worth putting back on. I think it's a nice picture of your dad and President Obama.
That's right, international man of mystery, and President Obama.
That's right. That's right. When you and I talked when we were on Skype and we talked about your family, and I was saying to you that you talk about your dad starting as the office boy in the company. It's quite a movement, isn't it, from office boy to shaking hands with President Obama. What do you put that down to? How did he do that?
So he worked incredibly hard. So that's thing number one. He was a hard worker, and he didn't really give up. So he was the seventh of eight children, and the youngest son, which means he was really very low in the pecking order, and certainly in kind of quite patriarchal, hierarchical Korean societies. And he didn't do as well as he'd expected at school. He didn't get to the best universities. And he couldn't afford at that time to do the diplomatic exams because he was getting married to my mother. And so things were hard. So he joined this very small, not very highly reputed rubber and then tire company as the most junior executive. And then 46 years later now, my brother's 45, I'm 44, so he was there a year before we were born, before my brother was born. And he just kept at it, and he spoke English, so he was sent out to overseas postings. And so as a result, he was able to understand and learn from a whole variety of different cultural and business practices, which held him in good stead. And so... yeah, I mean, very impressive. I mean, when he retired from working, he still does some consultancy work. He was their longest-serving employee. And I think for the people who work there, particularly in Korea, where often it is very difficult to ascend the ranks in a company. I think he's unusual, firstly, to be a working CEO at the age of 71, as he was when he finished working in that role, and secondly, to have started really at the bottom of the bottom rung, and then to have worked up. And I think he rightly sees that as a good example, and I do too. Yeah.
Before we leave you, your dad and his kind of history, one of the things that I was really interested in, just because it's it's quite an unusual thing, really, was the ancestral lands that the family, the heritage family owned. What's the story with that area of land that belonged to the family?
So it's within. It's within artillery distance of the 38th parallel. So they were farmers. My father's parents and grandparents, and they owned a lot of land, but it really was, just south of the 38th parallel. So the story goes, and I guess Dad's a pretty good raconteur as well, so I'm not sure how true this is, but the story goes that his family's house was the first house commandeered by the North Korean forces on the 25th of June 1950 when they crossed over, and so they... the story is that they had heard from a relative who had northern sympathies that it was all going to kick off, so they got out just in time.
One of the questions that I didn't prime you to answer, anything could happen, as we talk about that, and we talk about the Korean War and how close your family's kind of home was to that, and some of it still is in that 38th parallel. Mm. For us, when we listen to the news about North Korea, our immediate response is conditioned to being one of really kind of rejecting it and almost despising it as a great enemy to the West. For your family, being so close to that, is it a different response? Is it a heartbroken response, or is it a what is the response?
It's difficult to overstate how close people feel to the people of North Korea when you're in the South. That sense is probably ebbing, well, actually statistically it's ebbing away as fewer people have a memory of the war and the divisions and the famine, the difficulties caused by the war. But so my maternal grandmother, my mum's mum, came from the village in the north, and she came to Seoul to marry my granddad, and that was it. She never saw her family again. Some of my father's uncles, one of them, did defect to the north. He didn't defect, he simply had political sympathies, and the war started, there he was. These divided families, it's a divided people. It's not a situation where... it's never that polarized. It's never that simple. One of the security ministers from North Korea came over in the mid-90s, and my grandmother recognized him as his brother because of a particular deformity he had in his hand. And so she found out, but she never saw him when he visited, even though she had the opportunity to, because there's just too much history that's passed between them. It's a tragedy of kind of epidemic proportion, really. But increasingly, the sense is that the younger generation doesn't want to reunify. Well, there's a political pressure not to. I'm not sure I'm the best person qualified to comment on
that's
that.
Right. You did well on an off-the-cuff answer there, I tell you. That was pretty good. So the family moved around all over the world, from Korea to Kuwait, back to Korea, UK, and then mother and father went to America.
States, and then Germany.
How much did that mean that you let go of your cultural Korean kind of norms or the family? Does the family, your parents' family, they still very Korean? Do you consider yourself to be Korean, or are you, you know, a global citizen or very much a British citizen?
I mean, that's a really hard question to answer, because where does identity lie? My father's, both my parents' families obviously are very traditionally Korean, very conservative, but yet because of the way they moved around, and because their particular skill set, I guess, languages and their natural charm, which regrettably hasn't been inherited, they've been very adaptable. But I think when it comes to identity, it's very difficult to, I mean, I don't know, what does being a Korean feel like? What does being a British person feel like? I mean, I don't know. There is this phenomenon that academics write about, this third culture kid phenomenon, where you're not quite one and not quite the other. And whilst that makes, it does make, you know, languages easier to learn, having learned two languages from an early age, learning a third or fourth doesn't pose too many problems. You become quite easily adaptable to different cultural situations. There's also a sense that you belong neither to one or the other. I have to say, the older I get, the more paradoxically I miss Korea, where I've never really lived, where I have very strong memories. And so I guess it's a slight yearning for what one didn't have. But at some point, you just have to accept the situation you're in. And you have to accept that, actually, yes, there are challenges of being in between cultures, but actually there are great privileges and opportunities as well. That's the best non-answer I can give there, I think.
So perhaps this is a question for your children, who we'll talk about in a little bit. But do you think for them, there is a sense of identity with Korea when they visit, or do you think it is a very kind of not an alien place to them, but you know, in no way is there a sense that this has anything to do with them except they visit their grandparents?
So I'd love to say I can't speak for my children, but I will.
Where's that? One of them is here this evening. So
I am going to speak for you, because I'm here and you're there. But look, I think they both really enjoy going to Korea, and I think they both enjoy seeing their parents, their grandparents. And to her enormous credit, Eleanor has, despite my failure to teach her and Lauren Korean, is learning it by herself online. So, you know, I'm fortunate that they're made of sterner stuff, and they have more motivation and commitment to learning Korean than perhaps I did. But that perhaps gives an indicator of the fact that they do, you know, have at least a reasonably strong connection to Korea.
So you came to the UK six?
Yeah, well, five and a bit.
And when we talked, you said to me that was the point at which, you know, you could do your ABCs in English,
yeah,
but not much more. And you moved to Hampton, near Richmond, and that was kind of, that area stayed as being kind of the centre of your world until university. Mm. And we've got a very sweet. There's the school you're at. That's Hampton School.
The best school in the world.
The
obviously.
Best school in the world. Hampton School, an independent school. You know, I've got to be honest with you, Isik, you sound a clever chap. You do a clever job. Surely you could have made it into the grammar school.
No. I failed it. The result cost my parents a fair penny, I think.
So the answer was to send you to private school.
They made that decision. I think Lauren remains the only one of the four of us who's passed the 11 plus.
Lauren had.
Yeah.
Well, they'll all be glad you shared that. Yeah. So here is little Isak. At what age are you there, Isak?
That would have been about eight.
Eight. So is this seven, before eight. Hampton?
Yeah. That was Felcott School. Okay. Not great memories of that place, but.
So how was it coming from, from Kuwait, from Korea into a British school? How did that work for you?
Have you been to Azerbaijan?
No.
How would you feel if you went to school at the age of six in Azerbaijan?
I'd probably been a little nervous.
Yeah, so that's kind of how it felt, actually. And nothing against Azerbaijan, I'm sure it's lovely, actually. But genuinely not knowing, much at all. It was pretty. I mean, I remember my first day. It was frightening. I remember most days actually for the first year or so. It was frightening and challenging. But look, when you're five, you're six, you adapt very quickly. But I do remember being frightened. But yeah, I mean, we got over it briskly.
But Hampton School was a whole different kettle of fish for you, wasn't it?
Yeah. So it was an incredible environment, and it just had the right balance of teachers, the right balance of kind of academia versus extracurricular kind of resources and emphases, so that it was very much the sort of environment where they said, if you want to do something, whatever you're interested in, go for it, and we'll support you. So, if you're a sportsman, do sports, and we'll make sure you get good enough grades to do other things. If you're a classicist, do classics. And I had a great friend who really was just interested in history. And so the guys said, well, look, do history, forget about everything else. And he's a professor of history at a very prominent university now, and I won't name it, it wouldn't be fair, but they took people's skills, they looked at what they were good at and just let it grow. And again, I can remember most of my days at Hampton, and I there wasn't a dud one among them, I don't think. It was great.
And you're still in contact with staff and
students? So my best friends are still my school friends, my favourite teachers I still keep in touch with, and I'm very grateful to them.
So was academic success an important goal for you? Was it an important goal for your parents? Or were your parents kind of able to say, Isak, just, develop?
Just chill out. Do your thing. No. No. I mean, so, look, I think I probably had reasonably high standards of myself, but, I mean, it was pretty much expected that implicitly and explicitly that, you've come to this country, going to a good school, there is no excuse not to do well. And, it was an absolute, really, that studying and academic success came above pretty much everything else, really. And, that took its toll, but ultimately, you come out of it whole, one hopes. But, it was pretty stressful. And one thing to mention is that my dad was called back to another post in Korea. So he was made an executive director in 1989-90, just before I started my GCSEs. And so my mother stayed behind in England, visiting sporadically, for a period of, 3 or 4 years, which was a huge sacrifice from their point of view. Yeah. So it was a non-negotiable that we did the best we could.
There was another non-negotiable, really, wasn't there, which was kind of decided while you were still little in Kuwait.
Yeah, I mean, one night, this is my dad telling the story with no doubt a golden retroscope, when we were one and my brother was two in Kuwait, before we knew we'd be coming to the UK, my dad said, this one will go to Oxford and this one will go to Cambridge. And, which is you might argue was a slightly unnecessary pressure to put on your, you know, as yet non-verbal children, but, you know. But that's, you know, the expectation was very clear, and it was absolute.
Now, I mean, we ought to make equally clear before we make your dad sound draconian, that when we talked, you said that actually for a Korean family, you were a very warm family.
Oh, incredibly.
You know, so we would hate anybody to get the impression that, you know, this was not all surrounded by the love of a loving, open family.
Oh, look, and there's, you know, there's also this is my version of things,
okay.
You know, but I'm here, and they're 5,000 miles.
Well, next time your dad comes over, we might ask him to do Sunday.
They were incredibly and remain incredibly generous. And actually, only when you become parents yourselves do you realise actually how much of a sacrifice you make, very happily and freely, and without, you know, without any condition really.
So you made the grade. You went to Oxford and you studied at Pembroke College there in the City of Dreaming Spires. And you went to read chemistry because going to do medicine was too competitive.
Yeah, it's slightly painful to admit that now, I have to say. But, you know, the expectation was to go to a certain place. And I think probably, I liked chemistry, and I did harbour some ambitions of doing chemistry research, and you know, the end of it, PhD was dangled in front of me in physical chemistry. But probably my first ambition was to do medicine. But I mean, at some conscious or unconscious level, I probably chickened out a bit actually, because it was so much harder. And there was a very clear expectation to go to a certain place. So, I mean, would I have got in for medicine? I don't know.
And you didn't do medicine at Cambridge, did you?
I'd had enough after 4 years. So I went to UCL.
Okay. Which you described to me as...
It was a very large and slightly impersonal place, actually.
That wasn't what you...
was it not?
That's not what I was going for. Best medical school in the country was what I was going for.
It is the best medical... It is, if not the world. Harvard Medical School has nothing on UCL on the top of Euston Road. But it was very good, but it was not the nice, personal... friendly kind of 300-person environment that UCL was. Was it good medical school? It was fantastic, and they worked you hard. Right. I didn't work very hard, but they kind of insisted on.
Why respiratory medicine? Why not something sexy like being a surgeon or a, you know, one of the really kind of impressive things? Why?
Because there is only one person in this in God's earth who thinks I'm sexy. Number one. And perhaps after 18 years, I think perhaps even that might be waning. that's thing number one. Thing number two, look, I mean, you've got to breathe, right?
Yeah.
And at a fundamental level, look, I mean, you know, being a surgeon is hard. Being in general practice means you have to know loads, and oh my goodness, I just couldn't do it. You know, renal medicine, neurology, they're very clever. But respiratory medicine, it's air in, air out, good oxygen in, bad carbon dioxide out. I mean, how hard can it be? And I do that bit of respiratory medicine that's to do with the ventilation. And ventilation is literally getting air in and out. And I do a particular thing called non-invasive ventilation, which... where you apply a mask that just pushes air in, and then the machine does nothing whilst you breathe out. So it couldn't be simpler, really. And it just appeals to my kind of sense of trying to have an easy life, really. Incidentally, we respiratory physicians say non-invasive ventilation was the first medical intervention actually described. You know, God breathed life into Adam.
Oh, you see.
Through his nostrils, so non-invasive ventilation.
Yeah.
Just saying.
In the footsteps of the Creator. Yeah. Fantastic. Well, before we leave Oxford behind, it's worth mentioning one other significant thing that happened on your first day at Oxford. Just tell us about your version of events.
My version, which is true and incontrovertible, as Donald Trump would say. So on the first day, I'm absolutely certain I saw Kate's dad's silver Volvo pulling up inside the quad, and I'm absolutely certain I helped her get her stuff out. And you know, 3 years later, two years later, we started going out. But Kate has very little memory of this sentinel moment, this seminal moment in our lives together.
You have clear memories of that.
And, absolutely. It might have been someone else, of course.
Well, I hope not, because I'm going to say next. So let's really hope it wasn't, because I asked you what it was about Kate that made you know that she was the one for you. And you gave me two answers to that. I wonder if you can remember them.
Well, I can remember one, and I think I can make up the other. But
I've written it down, so I'll
I think
you.
Those of you who know Kate, and if you don't... I mean, I think she is the most incredible human being, and I'm glad this is being recorded, because if ever if I'm struck down by lightning or by a bus, you know, I think she's the most kind, humane, understanding, principled individual that I've ever met, bar none. And she was that when she was 18. She was that when she was 22 when we started going out. She was that when I proposed. And she was that when we got married. And she remains that today. So that remains a constant in my life, actually. It's a pretty good constant to have, I think. What was the second thing?
The second thing, if I just check my notes, which is, and she had an awesome figure.
Oh, she did. She did. Yeah, so she did. So she did all the theatre productions. She was a kind of National Youth Theatre Gold Medalist. You know, she did all the big theatre productions at university. And I always used to say, Kate never walked. She never walked. She'd always glide. And I think she still does. Yeah. Anyway, that's...
No, I think that's fabulous. When I asked you and you said, you know, and she had an awesome figure, which helps...
Didn't know I could say that in church, actually.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. Definitely, absolutely. Did she take much persuading to go out with you and to marry you?
Oh, she was way out of my league. I mean, remains way out of my league. And did she need... do you know what? For a long time, Korean culture wasn't at the forefront of the British consciousness, but now it is, thanks to K-pop and BTS and all the food. But I always like to think that she was an early adopter of Korean culture. Did she need much persuading? I think perhaps actually in the early days it was, I was probably a bit arm's length, because I think, I mean, she was a very good thing. And it took a long time to persuade myself that actually this could be a thing. If I'm honest.
You weren't the only one who took some persuading, though, were you? Your parents weren't sure at the idea at first of you marrying going out with a non-Korean.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a little bit of, there was a frisson, let's say, of doubt in their minds. But then they met her. She came over to New York just before Christmas as it started snowing in 1997. And, you know... I think there are certain qualities that transcend kind of national differences, cultural differences, really. And Kate has those positive traits in spades, really. So I think it was a done deal. But before that, of course, before they met her, they arranged plenty of blind dates with having some very, very nice young Korean ladies.
The daughters of good Korean families.
Yeah. Yeah, never really had a connection with...
I mean, as you told me when we Skyped, really, it was just a good opportunity for a free dinner on the...
I'm not sure I would have said that in church, but yeah, thank you. Yeah.
It is a bit like the confessional here, you have to...
confidential
yeah, don't tell anybody, it's... Yeah, don't tell anybody. You get married, and we've got a photograph of you on your wedding day outside Pembroke Chapel, where you married.
Yes.
And so how old are you there?
26.
You look very happy.
Yeah.
Yeah?
It was a good day.
Yeah, it looks a good day. So you get married, and then a little bit later on, along comes Eleanor, who's with us this evening somewhere. So Eleanor was born in, this is the test of any dad, was born in what year?
2005.
2005.
Day after fireworks day.
Okay, there she is.
Yeah.
And behind her, lying on Kate's lap, is
Lauren.
Yeah. And so what year was that?
2009, March. 2009. You're testing me here. I wasn't going to get these wrong. Not when we're being recorded.
Tell us a little bit about your lovely daughters.
Yeah, they're great.
Yeah, we'll see another picture of them in just a moment. But tell us a bit about them.
So they are great. They are, as you can see, they're gorgeous. They are intelligent and they are charming. And, oh look, they have their moments, we know. We all know, but in every respect, certainly in all three respects, they take after their mother. When you asked me for a photo of me cradling in my arms, I think as a family we agreed that a photo of Kate holding the girls was probably a better reflection of reality. I mean. So, but they very much take after her, and so they are very lucky girls indeed.
And as we said at the beginning, you know, we gave that list of the things that you do, and on your Twitter bio, you must tweet more often because you really don't tweet an awful lot.
You can get into trouble on Twitter, though.
Well, you can, but there's very little for people when they go digging to find. But in your bio, it says that chesty doctor, I think you say, husband. And father, not always in that order. How do you do the dad bit, being so busy? How important are the girls to you?
How do I? I'm up here and you're down there, Eleanor. But again, I think I do a fantastic job. I spend all the time that they need. I help. I think I do it poorly. I think I'm a better dad now than I was when they were very young. And certainly in the early days when I was training and not being home very much and being wedded to the work to a greater extent, I don't think I was a good father at all. But yeah, you're as good a dad as the amount of time you invest in it. And the amount of effort you make. And it took probably more time than it should have to realize that. But I think I'm probably slightly better at it now than I was. Time is always an issue. And as Kate says, there's always someone who's unwell at 5:30, 6 in the evening that keeps you for a little bit longer. But I don't think that's unique to medicine, those sort of last-minute demands. And I think at some stage you have to make a choice and come to an acknowledgement of the balance that you have to attain for yourself and the family as to how much time you spend doing each of the things that matter to you.
Yeah. I think it's fair to say when we see you with the children, actually, there is no sense that you've actually not been a very good dad. So you may just be being a little bit hard on yourself there. Let's just relieve you of a little bit of that burden, I think. And let's not just take it all on yourself. Kate is a very accomplished and clever woman in her own right. She's a district judge.
That's right.
And in the family division, we've got a photo of her there in her robes with the girls. Fair to say to the girls that they're a lot bigger than that now, but that's Kate in her her judge's robes. And we'd love one day to have her sit in this seat too, but that might not be quite so easy for her with her role. So you both have really high-pressure jobs where it's not an exaggeration to say that you both hold people's futures in your hands. How do you balance all these sets of demands? Because, as you say, they are real demands, aren't they? You know, it's not just... they're not jobs that have no consequences to people's lives. These are jobs that can change somebody's future forever.
I think that's true. But firstly, I think we fool ourselves if we think certain jobs are somehow more stressful than others. Because I think everyone who has to support a family, everyone who has to work hard to, you know, it's a cliche, but get food on the table, keep a roof over their heads, works hard, and is subject to stress, which genuinely affects people's lives, their own, their families, the people whom they serve at work. So I think that's it's really important to acknowledge that. It is certainly true that in medicine, and in Kate's particular area, that we do affect people in a very personal and direct way. I have the benefit and the privilege of working with some hugely talented individuals, so we like to spread the stress and the responsibility amongst us. Kate's job is harder in the sense that a lot of the consequences of those decisions that she alone makes rest on her shoulders. So I guess it's important to say those things first, but how do we balance it? The bottom line is Kate runs the show. She does the organising, she makes sure everything gets done at home, she makes sure the girls are sorted. The girls increasingly sort themselves out. But the rest of it is a balance. I try to be around as much as I can. I think I help more with the maths than perhaps Kate does. Look, it's a cliche, but I'm Oriental, I wear glasses, I'm going to be decent at maths, aren't I? I'm going to say it before you all think it, it's fine. So I'll probably help a bit more with the schoolwork, I think. And I try and encourage the girls to do a bit more running. But apart from that, I think leadership is important. And actually, at some point, you have to acknowledge that, yes, there are certain things where I lead. But actually, organisational things at home, Kate is much stronger at. And that's the bottom line, isn't it? That... Yeah, so that's the first thing. So practically speaking, Kate runs the show. Secondly, at some point you have to acknowledge that you're not in control of this situation. And we were talking earlier about how we manage the complexities of life, and life just gets more complex as time goes on. And actually a reductionist approach, actually simplifying everything and saying, right, we will do X, Y, and Z and nothing else, doesn't work. And so at some point you have to acknowledge that both individually and corporately we have to look to other ways, other sources of comfort, other sources of peace internally and also within the family. And actually that's where I think our faith is a very important factor. Not because it tells us what to do, because it guides us and it also gives us comfort when we inevitably and consistently and catastrophically get it wrong a lot of the time. So those are my three points.
Okay. We're going to leave it there. A chance for you to stretch your legs and for you to grab a quick bit of refreshment if you want. And we'll be back in 10 or 15 minutes. Thank you very much, Ethic.
Thank you.